Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily political podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast and I'm today joined by James Forsyth and Katie Walls. So Parliament's back and Theresa May's Brexit problems seem to have restarted again. At this point, it seems like the DUP is the biggest problem. James, what are they up to?
So Arlene Foster, the leader of the DUP, is in Brussels today meeting Michel Barnier, and she's given a press conference and she's removed the bit of wiggle room that people thought Theresa May might have on the backstop, which is there was some excitement that a statement she released last night suggested that while she didn't want any regulatory checks on goods going from Great Britain to Northern Ireland, her only red line was checks on goods going from Northern Ireland to Great Britain. But this morning, first in an interview on Radio Ulster, and then in Brussels, she's clarified. She said, no, any barriers between GB and Northern Ireland, either way, would be unacceptable to them. And we're now left wondering what the government are going to do on the backstop.
Yeah, I think there was a wave of optimism across Westminster yesterday afternoon when the statement came out, something that James documented on Coffee House, because it did appear to provide some wriggle room for Theresa May. But the government needs to get the EU withdrawal bill basically, you know, substantially there in the next couple of days into next week before they have their next big EU council meeting. One of the crucial issues is the Irish border, and this suggested that Theresa May would be able to budge a bit. That has not happened. Arlene Foster has completely ruled that out, and I think there is little reason to think that she is suddenly going to change her red line. And that poses a big problem to this government, because there are some in government who do think that they can bounce the DUP into submission, that actually when push comes to shove, the DUP will just have to like or lump it, because they're not going to vote down the government and pave the way to Jeremy Corbyn, someone who is more against their values than the Conservative government. But this is also the DUP that we have had my favourite ever source quote from, where they described their negotiating position. They said, well, we're waiting for someone to blink and we've cut our eyelids off. They're not one to bend. And I think this is the problem here. I don't see how they're really going to change their mind. And that means if they persevere by saying that we will not have any difference treatment to Northern Ireland to the rest of the UK, that means that I think number 10 could either be pushed into a softer Brexit, so one with a form of customs union, not something the DUP really want, they are for Brexit, or a no deal Brexit, which, you know, raises lots of questions, but it would mean in theory that the whole UK was treated the same.
I was talking to someone close to DUP leadership late last week, and they were making the point that one of the things that is animating the DUP position is that they are very suspicious that number 10 is about to try and bounce them. They are getting whispers back from Brussels of what the UK might be proposing behind the scenes, and they don't like the sound of it. So I think what you're seeing is a kind of preemptive strike against that. I mean, there is a big question here for Theresa May, though, because it is worth remembering. Everyone talks about last December when the DUP pulled the plug on the initial version of a joint report, led to that paragraph 50 being added to it, which basically says that, you know, none of this means any barriers between Northern Ireland and Great Britain. But Theresa May went back to sign off on that version of the joint report without the DUP's assent. She tried to get it from Arlene Foster. She couldn't. And she decided that she had no choice but to go and sign the deal anyway and run the risk with the DUP. I wonder if that is where Downing Street are heading again. That they will try to bind the DUP in, but ultimately, when push comes to shove, if they feel they can't get the DUP to move, they will run the risk. And it is a big risk. Katie was saying that the DUP and Jeremy, you know, lots of Tories think the DUP would never do anything that might create the risk of a Jeremy Corbyn government, given his previous views on the IRA, his openness to Irish unification. I mean, he views that as a positively good thing. But I understand that DUP have been emphasising to cabinet ministers, and were doing so at Tory conference, that, you know, if preserving the union as they see it requires running the risk of a Jeremy Corbyn government, they would take that risk.
We're also expecting this afternoon this statement by Dominic Raab, where he'll be updating MPs on the Brexit negotiations. And the ERG are also going to be discussing their next steps. James, do we have a sense of what they're going to be planning?
I mean, this is a big question now, which is, and this again comes back to a point that Katie's written a blog on this morning, which is, if you lose the DUP, suddenly the number of ERG rebels, the government could do quite a good job and get it down to, say, below 20. But that combined with the DUP, it's still very hard to see how they make that up with Labour MPs. This is why the DUP is so key. Because if you take those 9 DUP votes out of the equation, suddenly the ERG rebellion becomes more significant. I think that today, just watch to see what their mood is in the chamber. And I think, and how difficult they are prepared to be to the government.
You've had Steve Baker come up today with a number of 40 ERG rebels as the number they're putting on it. I think by the time you get to the vote, there's an expectation that number would probably reduce a bit, because when push comes to shove, some people will actually think, actually, let's just get out, and then let's try and refine it later, the Michael Gove approach. There's also a chance, though, that there is a big concession before we get there, and it becomes very hard politically to sell, and it becomes a bigger number. But I think all the signs at the moment suggest that actually, say you might have around 20 ERG rebels, if you can get your Labour MPs, around 20 who are, you know, represent Leave constituencies, you can see how they would perhaps get over the line. I think what hasn't helped the ERG is there's been the reports over the weekend, you know, about the different plans to vote down the budget, and then you had Bernard Jenkin denying them, and it definitely, they seem to be fighting each other a lot of the time. And I think that's been a big problem in recent months, where there hasn't been a clear alternative, and they do look like a group that haven't actually decided what their best tactic is, partly because I think they thought they had a lot more power than they do.
It wouldn't be Eurosceptics if there wasn't the Judeans' People's Front and the People's Front of Judea and all this. I think one of the other reasons why the numbers will reduce as the time comes is not only the risk that if you vote down the deal, you know, maybe you get a second referendum or no Brexit, but I think also, you know, it is hard to believe. Now, we can have an academic conversation about whether if the government had started preparing, as it should have done, for no deal from the morning after the referendum, whether it would be a viable option. But given that preparations only seriously started this summer, I mean, there's a real question about, you know, whether no deal would do, whether no deal would essentially ensure a Corbyn government at some point in the future, because the chaos would be such that the public would think, bloody hell, this lot can't run a bath.
And in all this, we're repeatedly seeing Dominic Raab sent in, as he has been today by Theresa May in the chamber, to update Brexiteers on the situation. And there's lots of people who thought Theresa May should be the one giving today's statement, which is the most recent one on Salzburg, because Parliament's been away for the conferences. But I think one of the reasons Number 10 are quite keen to have Dominic Raab talk on this is not just that they don't want Theresa May to get tricky questions from backbench MPs, it's that Dominic Raab is ultimately a Brexiteer, so they think it is a bit of a safer face to put out there when they have difficult things to say.
And finally, on to Labour, who are mooting this plan for a four-day week. Katie, what do you make of it? Good idea?
I mean, I think it's an interesting idea. I don't know if I'd go as far as good. We also had the Green Party last week at their conference suggesting that we need to look at people's recess hours or their downtime as a way to measure like happiness. And that was suggesting, the implication was at least, that people spend too much time at work. This takes it a step further if it's to, you know, to actually go through, because it does suggest a Labour government would try and legislate a four-day week. I think lots of my friends have quite flexible working hours. And actually, if you look, there's more and more people who are self-employed. So people do choose to kind of work the hours they want. I'm quite uncomfortable with the idea of legislating those. So if I want to work 5 days, I'm not supposed to, or I have to have some kind of workaround.
James, I mean, why are Labour coming up with these sorts of ideas at this point?
I mean, they're meant to be eye-catching, popular. They show that they're for the workers. And it's kind of classic Marxist philosophy, isn't it? That basically, at some point, people should be liberated from work. Well, I think you can argue that work is an empowering thing. So, but I think this will be one of the kind of big political contentiousness of recent times. As Katie was saying, the Greens are talking about measuring time off. You know, this idea that there's been this incredible technological change, and contrary to what people expected, it hasn't actually, for lots of people, produced more free time. It's actually produced more working time. And I think coming up with kind of political answers to that, look, I think this four-day week is a very crude idea, but political answers to that question, I think that's definitely fertile political territory.
Thank you, James, and thank you, Katie.